Today on Renewing Your Mind, nowhere in Scripture do we see the term Pope. So where did the early church come up with that office?
If all of life, if heaven's a hierarchy with God and the saints and angels, if politics is a hierarchy, then isn't it just almost automatic, inevitable, that we have to think of the church as a hierarchy too?
Well, as we just heard Dr. Robert Gottfried say there, hierarchy in the church is logical from a human standpoint, but we need to ask if it's scriptural. You're listening to Renewing Your Mind, and on this Saturday, Dr. Gottfried joins us to continue his survey of church history. As you can imagine, covering 2,000 years of church history is a monumental task. So we'll be spending the next several months here on the Saturday programs studying this topic. Dr. Gottfried is a well-known and respected church historian and one of our Ligonier Teaching Fellows. Let's join him now in the classroom.
Well, we're returning to our study of the ancient church, and we've been looking in the last little while at some of the developments of piety in the ancient church. And although we're going to be slightly out of order chronologically, I think it'd be good to go on with part of the development of that piety, that more practical life of the church. You know, often when we study the history of the church, we study particularly the history of theology in the church, and that's very important, very valuable. But an awful lot of Christians through the centuries have not lived primarily in a world of theology, but in a world of practice and of piety and of the life of the church. So it's important as we study the history of the church to look at that piety, that level on which many Christians function, as well as at the theology of the church. And so I want to go back and think with you a little bit about the ministry in the church as part of its piety, and look at particularly the question of where did the Pope come from? How are we to understand the papacy? What is the rise of the papacy? Because this is very much related to the life of the church and the piety of the church. Well, now I talked to you earlier about bishops and who bishops were in the ancient church period. That bishops were really best to be understood in terms of kind of senior preachers in churches. But over time, as the church grew and as the church expanded through the centuries, bishops did begin to evolve in major cities into being not only preachers, but also somewhat administrative figures. So we see the episcopal office kind of evolving in the direction of what we know of as bishops today. Although throughout the whole ancient church period, bishops remained primarily preachers. That continued to be their number one function. But they did, in especially larger cities, begin to have more administrative responsibilities as well. Now, you know the word bishop comes from the Greek word episkopos, from which we get our word episcopal, and it simply means an overseer. And when you look in Paul's pastoral letters, you see that he uses the word overseer as completely synonymous with the word presbyter, or presbyteros in Greek. A presbyter is an elder, pointing to wisdom and maturity. An episkopos is an overseer, pointing to responsibility. These are not competing titles, but they are really synonyms for the same office. The way we talk about a pastor and a minister, we're not talking about different things. We're talking about the same office described from slightly different perspectives. But as the later church, ancient church, developed, there began, again, partly because of this hierarchical thinking, to think of the bishop as standing over the priest. Now, the English word priest has an interesting history. The word priest in English is actually a contraction of the Greek word presbyteros. So you can see the P, the R, the S, and the T in the English word priest. So the ancient title for, often translated in English, priest, should not be associated in the first place with a sacrificing priesthood or the priesthood of the Old Testament. It's really a word more related to the idea of elder in Paul's writing. But what you begin to see is a kind of hierarchy emerging with the bishop at the top and increasingly his priests under him. And so the bishop begins to have a regional authority. In part, that's related to the growth of the church. When the church in the ancient world began to grow, it grew first of all in the cities and only much more slowly out into the countryside. As a matter of fact, the English word pagan is derived from the Latin word meaning rural. So pagan religion survived in the countryside longer than it survived in the cities. And Christianity came first to the cities. The bishop then was established in the city. And as Christianity began to move more slowly outside the cities into the countryside, the bishop remained sort of the supervising clergyman over these priests who now went out into the countryside. And so his role as bishop began to grow. And again, this kind of hierarchical way of thinking began to set in. It only makes sense, doesn't it, that there would be superior clergymen and inferior clergymen. Because after all of life has superiors and inferiors. I had a chance to go to Korea and to preach in some of the Presbyterian churches there. And traditional Korean society is radically hierarchical. There is no notion of equality amongst people in Korea. Everyone is superior or inferior in the traditional Korean vision of reality. And if you're equal in every other way, then the older person is superior to the younger person. Surprised me at first. Everywhere I went, people asked me how old I was. And I didn't know whether that's because I looked older than they thought I should be or younger than they thought I should be. But it's because it's critical to the social relationships. Just going through the door. The older person is supposed to go through the door first. It would be very rude for a younger person to go through the door before an older person. It's all hierarchical. And so it was in the ancient world. So if all of reality is hierarchical, then it must be that bishops are superior to priests, as priests must be superior to parishioners. It just seems automatic. It seems natural. That being the case, it's not surprising that over time, the church began to conclude that some bishops are more important than other bishops. If the hierarchy is from parishioner to priest, then it's not much of a jump to say, well, then it's also from priest to bishop and from bishop to archbishop. If all of life, if heaven's a hierarchy with God and the saints and angels, if politics is a hierarchy, then isn't it just almost automatic, inevitable that we have to think of the church as a hierarchy too? And in very practical terms, people began to say, well, it must be that the bishops of the really important cities are the really important bishops. So the bishop of Jerusalem must be a particularly important bishop because Jerusalem's an important city, at least spiritually. And the bishop of Alexandria and the bishop of Antioch and the bishop of Constantinople. These are all major cities over time in the ancient world. These must be particularly important bishops. Now, those of you who are really good at geography will have immediately noticed that Jerusalem, Antioch, Alexandria, Constantinople are all in the eastern part of the Mediterranean. And there's one more bishop who belongs on that list of bishops of particularly important cities. And that, of course, is the Bishop of Rome. Rome is an important city. And so you have five most important bishops because they're in these most important cities. We think that way a little bit, don't we, today? If there's a pastor in a really big church in a really big city, he must be a better pastor than some poor pastor in a small town in some rural area, right? That's the way they thought in the ancient church too. And the Bishop of Rome then has the unique situation of being the only Western bishop in this list of really important bishops. And so the Bishop of Rome saw himself as important. And the church saw him as important from relatively early on. But what's interesting is that later in the life of the church, the argument began to be made by the Roman Catholics and to some extent by the Eastern Orthodox that power in the church flows from the top down. And again, that's the way hierarchical thinking would lead you to think. In the heavenly pyramid, power flows down, doesn't it? God's at the top. Power flows from him. In the earthly pyramid of the empire, the emperor is at the top, and power flows from him down to others. And so over time, the church began to think, well, also in the church, power, life must flow from the top down. That's the way all of reality functions. So it must be that way in the church. In some way, the bishop must be the source of the life of the church. And the bishop is the one who comes to define the church and define the life of the church. And that just makes sense. But when you actually go back to look at the experience of the church in that ancient period, the bishop, and particularly the archbishops, were not seen as the ones from whom life came, but they were seen more as appellate courts. If we have a local problem in the local congregation or in the local bishopric that we can't solve locally, well, let's ask the archbishop for help. Not in the first place because he's the source of authority, but because he's a wise, experienced man, or he wouldn't have become an archbishop, and he can help us out. So it's a court of appeal initially to appeal to these great bishops. And only gradually does it develop that these great bishops begin to say, no, really, you know, it's not that you're appealing to me and investing my office with more authority, but your life comes from me. And archbishops began to say, well, you know, before you elect a new bishop, bishops locally had always been elected by the congregation the way we elect a minister. The archbishops began to say, well, you know, you really better get my approval before you elect somebody. They began to accumulate power to themselves. And it is true that from fairly early on, bishops of Rome began to argue that they had a special place in the life of the church. And that argument resonated with many Christians. After all, Rome was the capital city of the empire. It's where the emperor was. And therefore, Rome was particularly important, and therefore it made sense that the bishop of Rome would be particularly important. And so, for the first time, probably in the middle of the 3rd century, often in the study of the ancient church, you have to say probably, because we don't know as much as we'd like to know. The historical record, particularly of the 2nd and 3rd century, is really pretty sketchy. We have evidence, but we're never quite sure how full that evidence is. But in the middle of the 3rd century, about 250, as far as we can tell, for the first time, a bishop of Rome quoted the words of Jesus to Peter, "You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." And it was Pope Stephen, about 250, for the first time said, "This shows the primacy of the bishop of Rome." This shows that in some fundamental way, the whole church rests on the bishop of Rome. Now, if we are a Roman Catholic apologist, we'd say, well, 250, that's a long time ago. But from the perspective of the church, it had been going without apostles for 150 years, which is also a long time, without this papal claim. But even more importantly, we have to recognize it's one thing to claim something, and it's quite something else for anybody to pay attention to the claim. And for a very long time, the bishops of Rome did make claims for themselves, but the rest of the church wasn't buying it, wasn't paying attention. The bishops of Rome had more success in the West, of course, because they didn't have as much competition. But in the East, there was very little inclination to grant that the bishop of Rome was in charge. For example, at the First Ecumenical Council at Nicaea, where the whole church was represented, there is no recognition in 325 that the bishop of Rome is in charge. There is a recognition of the five great bishoprics and that they have something of a court of appeals kind of role in the life of the church. Nicaea recognizes that. But Rome is not singled out. Rome is not recognized as the one in charge. And so Rome does gradually accumulate authority for herself in the West, but she never is able to establish that kind of authority, that kind of recognition in the Eastern Church. And it's really only at the end of the ancient church period, when the Roman Empire is cut in two, and West and East begin more and more to drift apart from one another, that Rome's claims for itself to be the real rock of the whole church becomes more and more powerfully stated. Now, there was one bishop of Rome in the ancient period who did make great claims for the papacy. Pope Leo I, known to history as Pope Leo the Great, who was pope from 440 to 461. And he did claim all power came from him. He was the one who said, I sit at the top of this pyramid, and any archbishop, any bishop, any priest derives his authority from me. And Rome today still likes to quote Leo I. But we have to remember that when Leo I made these statements, no bishop in Alexandria or in Antioch or in Jerusalem or especially in Constantinople would have paid any attention to that claim. They'd have said, oh, there go those Romans again, so taken with themselves. So we always have to keep that in mind, the difference between what is claimed and what is real. So we've gotten ahead of ourselves chronologically, but I think it does fit in with what we've been looking at in terms of the hierarchy that so easily influenced the way that the church looked at spirituality. Well, we're coming up on the great divide in the history of the ancient church. And that great divide comes in the early 300s when the emperor Constantine becomes a Christian. Up until the conversion of Constantine, that is, up until about 315, 320, Christianity is officially an illegal religion. It is an illegal religion, and that means that the whole life of the church for its early centuries is a life lived knowing that Christians could be arrested and could be persecuted at any time. Now, why was Christianity an illegal religion? We began in this series talking about Rome's rather tolerant attitude to other groups and religions. How Rome was willing to make special provision for Jews in the empire. Why were they so intolerant of Christians? And the answer is that Christians were seen by the Romans as not being a nation the way Israel was seen as being a nation. They were not seen as being an ethnic group the way Jews were seen as an ethnic group. And for that reason, Rome said, Christians can make no claim for the special privileges that are accorded to Jews. This is also probably why lots of early Christians wanted to continue to go to the synagogue, because it would protect them from the Roman sense of Christians being illegal. And to be considered an illegal religion in the Roman world had very serious consequences. And from the Roman point of view, Christians were guilty of two great sins, to which they sometimes added a third. The two great sins were that Christians were atheists and that Christians were traitors. And then, somewhat thirdly, that Christians were engaged in gross immorality. That was the characteristic pagan Roman complaint against Christianity. Now, where do these complaints come from? Well, on the matter of immorality, a lot of Christian worship was kept secret because of persecution. And then Romans heard, what do Christians do in those secret worship services? Well, they drink blood, and they eat flesh, and they're engaged in love feasts, obviously sexual immorality. So cannibalism and sexual immorality, that's what goes on in Christian secret worship. It appears that at least some Romans actually believed that. Misunderstandings, of course, of the Lord's Supper, eating the body and drinking the blood of Christ, and calling that a love feast. But the more serious charges, in a sense, were atheism and treason. Now, what sense does it make to talk about Christians as atheists? Well, from the Roman point of view, it made a lot of sense. Christians deny the Roman gods. Christians will not worship the emperor. And therefore, they're atheists. They deny the gods. They can claim all they want to believe in one God, but they're denying what holds our society together. Romans were convinced that religion was the glue that held society together. Almost all ancient peoples believed that. If we're not agreed religiously, we can't have any unity. And so the Romans said, we need our gods, not just our gods, but we need our gods to hold our society together. If you deny the Roman gods, you're an atheist and you're a traitor. You're undermining the glue that holds the Roman Empire together. You won't honor the emperor. You won't put a pinch of incense at the statue of the emperor. What clearer evidence could you need that these people are social revolutionaries, that they're dangerous? And early on, there's a very interesting correspondence that takes place around the year 100 between the Emperor Trajan and Pliny the Younger. And Pliny says to the emperor, what am I supposed to do with these Christians? There seems to be Christians all over. He's in Asia Minor, modern Turkey. Am I supposed to hunt them out, or am I supposed to ignore them, or what am I supposed to do? And the emperor writes back and says, you know, don't hunt them out. We're too civilized for that as Romans. But if you come to know about them, and if they refuse to offer sacrifice to the image of the emperor, then put them to death. They're clearly dangerous. And that was sort of the Roman attitude. And what that meant is most Christians, most of the time, weren't subject to persecution. But the church lived under the constant possibility that persecution could break out at any time. And it did create in the mind and in the heart of the church a kind of worried spirit. What is really going to happen to us? What is going to become of us? And when in the middle of the 3rd century, after there had been great growth, the emperor Decius attacked the church, there was vast apostasy. Many deserted the church rather than die. And that was a wake-up call to the church that led to greatly increased discipline and instruction in the life of the church, so that when 50 years later another great persecution broke out around the year 300 under the emperor Diocletian, there was much more faithfulness, much more holding together to the church. So the early church really was a church of the persecuted in mind, if not always in reality, and led to great discipline. And so as we come to the end of this lecture, it reminds us how crucial the conversion of the emperor was. Because when the emperor was converted, suddenly Christians passed from being an illegal religion to being a legal religion, and pretty much the days of persecution were over, and a whole new episode begins in the life of the church. And we'll take that up next time.
The idea of persecution scares us a little bit, doesn't it? But we learn from church history that persecution strengthens the church. It's been said that the blood of the martyrs is the seedbed of the church. You're listening to Renewing Your Mind, and on this Saturday edition of our program, we're presenting Dr. Robert Godfrey's Survey of Church History. It's a 73-lesson study series. Dr. Godfrey shows us that God has kept his promise to build his church. We'll be sharing all 73 lessons over the next several months. And we're making this series available to you on DVD as well. That's 12 DVDs, more than 21 hours of teaching, a $200 value. We'd like to send it to you for your gift of any amount. Contact us and request it. Our number is 800-435-4343, or you can give your gift online at renewingyourmind.org. Having a working knowledge of church history is relevant to our personal lives. It's important to know where we've come from so we don't repeat mistakes. Contact us today with your gift of any amount. Dr. Godfrey will equip you with a solid working knowledge of church history. We'll send you the 12 DVD set when you call us at 800-435-4343 or when you go online to renewingyourmind.org. Equipping the church is one of our main purposes here at Ligonier. The only way to effectively do that is by faithfully teaching God's Word. As a fellowship of theologians, pastors, and teachers, we have a large archive of sermons. You can hear a steady stream of faithful teaching on our 24-hour internet radio station. We call it RefNet. You'll hear teachers including John MacArthur, Alistair Begg, Albert Mohler, R.C. Sproul, and many others. Listen for free at refnet.fm or download the free RefNet app. Next Saturday, Dr. Godfrey continues this survey of church history. He'll be teaching about Emperor Constantine and the church. So we hope you'll make plans to join us on Renewing Your Mind.